This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm John Northcott. Welcome to Checkup's Ask Me Anything podcast. And today, that means you're about to hear our AMA with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield.
I was an astronaut for 21 years. I was only in space for 6 months. So for 20 and a half years, I was training and preparing and supporting other space flights.
Astronauts generally need to have three things. Number one, you need to be fit and be able to pass a really hard physical exam. Number two, you need to have an advanced education. And number three, you have to prove that you can make good decisions.
I've lived in orbit for about half a year, been around the world 2,500 times or so. Far and away, the best experience is to go outside on a spacewalk.
On Sunday, SpaceX launched its fifth Starship test flight. The company's goal is to build a reusable rocket that could reach the moon one day and maybe even Mars. When it comes to space exploration and what life is like in zero gravity, our AMA guest has the answers. Colonel Chris Hadfield was, of course, the first Canadian to walk in space, completing multiple space missions, space walks, and even serving as commander of the International Space Station back in 2013. The retired astronaut has also authored several books. He joined us recently to take your questions about all things space-related. Here are a few highlights from the show. Chris Hadfield, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John. Nice to be talking with you. And yeah, ask me anything. It doesn't even have to be space-related, whatever you like.
Well, I think there's probably enough just to talk about space because, and some of this was prompted by the fact that Barry Wilmore and Sonny Williams went up for 8 days, are now there for 6 months. And most of us, I think, if we had planned to go somewhere for a few days and then we're told we had to stay there for 6 months, might be a little daunted or perturbed by it all, but you say, uh-uh.
Yeah, it's a big misperception. The riskiest thing I've ever done in my entire life, and I used to be a combat fighter pilot, and I was a test pilot, both dangerous professions, but by far the most dangerous thing I've ever done is fly a rocket ship, and I've flown three. It's the most dangerous, you know, danger per second, because it's only about 8.5 minutes of anything. And so if you're going to take that enormous risk and fly a rocket ship, especially in the case of Sonny and Butch that you just mentioned, a rocket ship that had never been flown by human beings before, and then first people to ever fly that spaceship, a huge risk in trying to prove and include that new technology in human capability, to only go up for 8 days is kind of like a travesty. Because you've already taken all the risk. Why not stay? And so for their point of view, to then be told, okay, you're not just staying up for a week or two, but you get to stay a full long duration increment on the International Space Station. It's what astronauts train for. In the opener, you mentioned, I served as an astronaut 21 years, was only in space for 6 months. You know, so the vast majority of an astronaut's life is preparation and training for the rare privilege of actually serving in space. And so if you get extended, that's the greatest birthday present you could possibly have.
Okay. We're going to talk to Tristan LeClaire now, who has a question. Tristan, thanks for joining us. What's your question?
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on the show. First, I do have a question. But first, I did want to say thank you to Chris, because 10 years ago today, he gave a talk in, he gave a talk in Belleville, Ontario, and I was an air cadet at the time. I was 12, and you know, after the talk, everyone was lining up to shake hands with Chris Hadfield and have him sign our books, and I was a brand new cadet, didn't have a uniform, and he shook my hand, signed my book, told me what I needed to hear. Fantastic. Wanted to be an astronaut ever since. And but immediately after me, he shook the hand of a friend of mine who came from kind of a difficult household, and you stopped the whole line of people who were lining up to meet you, and you stopped them and taught this young boy how to properly shake a hand firmly and look someone in the eye. And that meant a lot for me. And I just wanted to thank you for that. And that's been a huge inspiration to become an astronaut, actually, because of that day. But I do have an actual question. And that is that with the increasing commercialization of the aerospace industry and space exploration and how important that's becoming in defense and science and, you know, just the spirit of space exploration. How do you see that affecting astronaut selection moving forward? And do you think that's going to be a positive or a negative thing overall for the industry?
Yeah, well, Trista, nice to hear from you again. And thank you very much for the kind words. I appreciate that. Spaceflight has always been commercial, right from the very beginning. It's always been things that were built by companies for profit. Always. The space shuttle that I flew was built by Rockwell. The space station was managed by Boeing. The lunar lander was built by Grumman. So it's always been commercial. The real difference now is that the technology is getting good enough and safe enough that the cost has dropped so low that now there are more customers than just the two biggest governments in the world. The cost is low enough now that private companies can afford to fly in space. And in fact, individuals, we're at the point now where you've got to be wealthy, but still it's new. Individuals can afford to buy a ticket and fly in space. So but that's a natural progression of any technology. It used to be very expensive to get a berth and sail across the Atlantic or to fly on board an airline. It used to be just for the very wealthy. And the technology has gotten better and those things have become much more commonplace. And I think it's a natural evolution. I think it's a healthy one. It's going to happen regardless. The real question, of course, is what's the purpose of it and how are we regulating it so that it fits properly into society, just like happened with those other technologies, even with cars. Picture the 1915 Model T when it rolled out suddenly with mass production and was a very brand new technology and very highly desirable item. The regulations were very minimal, very few roads, no infrastructure, driver's licenses, stop signs, stoplights, all of that stuff. They had to catch up. And that's where we are. And I think that's natural and okay. And technology always leads regulation. But for the last, 10,000 years, regulation has caught up. So I'm optimistic that it will. When you ask about what it means for astronauts, Tristan, and I'm glad that you're pursuing something as complex and demanding as that, I think rather than just being government employees, it's going to be possible to be a commercial astronaut as well. In fact, there's a Canadian who's already a commercial astronaut, Jamil Janjua, who was an F-18 pilot. He's a commercial astronaut for Virgin Galactic, and he regularly flies people to space and back. So it's a very different role. It's maybe the difference between being a barnstorming airshow pilot in 1915 and being an airline pilot today. You're both pilots, but it's a very, very different role. But it's a natural evolution. I think there will continue to be astronauts that are employees of the government for the pure exploration part of space. When Jeremy Hansen, Canadian, goes to the moon late next year, on board the Artemis ship, that's entirely a government venture, or at least a government organized and sponsored venture, and that's a good thing for professional astronauts to be doing. But as we discover valuable things on the moon, then it'll become more and more commercial, just like everywhere has happened on Earth. And I think it just behooves us then, how can we not just view this as a technological advance, but also as a new opportunity to think about how we geopolitically set things up. When we live on the International Space Station, we have a different set of laws than any country on Earth by the International Crew Code of Conduct. And so settling the moon, that's going to be it's as if we just discovered a new, completely uninhabited continent, and we have a clean slate of how we want to settle it. And it'll be a mixture of government astronauts, private astronauts, government exploration, private, scientific, all trying to figure that out. And I spent a lot of my time working with governments, and in fact, even with King Charles and private industry on just that question.
Tristan, thanks again. And perhaps I'll be interviewing you in 20 years. With any luck, that'll happen as well. So thanks again for your question. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lewis Reeford is from Toronto. Lewis, what is your question for Chris Hadfield?
Oh, hey there, Chris. Well, I could only say at breakfast this morning, wow, when I watched that launch and the subsequent two-part landing, it was absolutely mind-blowing. And I couldn't help but think, what an amazing company SpaceX really is. You talked about the importance of you know, what man in space, you know, travel has brought, and the teamwork that those guys exemplify to put that spacecraft, you know, into space and back down again, is incredible. How fast they're working to get what their prototype into the performance level that they've done. My question is more a geopolitical one, though, because I think SpaceX is making the Western space effort look really good, punching, you know, at its weight or maybe above its weight. But we see the Chinese doing their own version of SpaceX, maybe even better. And I'm just wondering your perspective. Do you think the Chinese will overtake the United States, the Europeans, and the Canadians with their spacecraft missions and ambition in the next decade or two? It's really a question. As we see them not necessarily going side by side with us, but trying to overtake us.
Thanks, Lewis. I too was amazed by, that's the first time in history that what happened this morning with that SpaceX launch with their Starship. For the folks who didn't watch it, the biggest rocket that we have ever built, it's twice as big as the rocket that took people to the moon in power. And it launched this morning on its fifth test flight. And it came back, rather than just falling in the ocean and turning into garbage and being wasted, it flew back, carefully maneuvered, and was grabbed by two long arms out of a big, strong tower. So now that rocket that just took a payload to space, which 17 million pounds of thrust, is now just hanging in the, get ready to be refueled and used again. It's a tremendous step forward. And you're right, it's a great tribute to all kinds of technology. We talk about where we are then in the world, of course. That rocket is leading the world. I think competition is healthy. Competition is necessary. I mean, it's why we have the Stanley Cup, right? If there was no cup at the end, then it'd be just sort of entertainment. But knowing that you're striving for something under the highest level of competition brings out the best in people. So there's nothing, it's why we have the Olympics, nothing wrong with competition. And in business, of course, competition is just as vital. And so to have the United States having great capability, India has just, they have their own rocket launch capability. They've selected astronauts. They've announced a very aggressive program, including putting Indian astronauts on the moon. And then China has a world-leading space program. And very recently, they landed on the far side of the moon with an unmanned vehicle and retrieved lunar samples and then launched from the other side of the moon, docked with a ship in lunar orbit, and then flew that back and re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. That's kind of a very good stepping stone towards putting people on the moon. And if you laid the moon out on Earth, it would be bigger than Africa. And it is a completely untapped resource. And there is no life there. There is no biology or biome or environment to disrupt. It's just rock. So if we can get the cost of access down low enough, it's a tremendous resource for us all, just like some of the resources on Earth, things that we need for 10 billion people to live well, sustainably. So it's an interesting moment in history that all these things are happening. But to look specifically at China, Lewis, there was a very interesting report put out by an Australian study group that lists the 64 leading technologies that we need as a society in order to make Earth sustainable with 10 billion people alive. Really important technologies that we need to advance, you know, power production and lots of healthcare and a bunch of other things. Of the 64 technologies that we need as a species and for the planet, 57 of them are being led in China right now and 7 in the United States. And everybody else is third or further down the list. So China, I definitely wouldn't want to live in China. It's not a political and societal regime that appeals to me, but they obviously have some tremendous capability and strengths, and that includes space flight.
Lewis, thank you so much for your call. Have a great weekend.
You too.
All the best. Chris, I'm kind of blown away with the sophistication of the questions that people have been throwing at you, everything from the meaning of life to geopolitics to the Van Allen belt. But can we talk a bit about the, because you started off talking and we've got just a couple of minutes left, but the person you were before you went into space, and then the person you came back to Earth as. People talk about being able to see the Earth and to realize its fragility. But what have you taken through life in terms of your takeaway from that experience that was your dream and then became your career and then happened?
Let me answer that in two parts, John. One, there's a friend of mine from Montreal named William Shatner, who was an actor, of course, and pretended to be the commander of the Starship Enterprise, did a great job, inspired me greatly, but I've gotten to know him. He's in his almost mid-90s now. But recently, Bill Shatner flew in space for real. And he was a pretty crusty and experienced guy. He'd done all kinds of things, had some real highs, real lows, made a lot of money, lost a lot of money, you know, interesting, colorful character. He only went on a very short space flight, about 15 minutes, just barely to the bottom of space. And I think everybody should listen to Bill Shatner's soliloquy that just poured out of his heart right after he landed. It shocked him. It stunned him. It changed his perception of the uniqueness and the fragility and the magnificence of our world in just a 15-minute space flight. And this is a pretty hardened guy. So I think that perspective is really important. But it wasn't the same for me, because I decided to be an astronaut when I was 9 years old, and I worked on it for my entire life. And so the lessons from it and the ideas of it, and then the verification of those ideas and the reaffirmation of them, those were gradual throughout my life. And flying in space three times, living in space for almost 6 months, going around the world 2,650 times, those deepened in me my sense of the world. But maybe what I took away the most was, one, we're all in this together, and we tend to forget that. The differences between us are minuscule, but we exaggerate them. But the fundamental desires of each of us and the challenges we face and the shortness of our lives, we all share. And that gets really strongly reaffirmed. Even though there are egregious examples of horrific human behavior, there are billions of examples of terrific human behavior every single day. And then the second is, so I'm both encouraged and recharged by that insight. The second is, the Earth is tough. The Earth's been here 4.5 billion years. Life has been on this planet uninterrupted for 4 billion years. If we made it our number one objective, we could not eradicate life on Earth. And if we want a good quality of life for ourselves as this human species and for the other 8 billion of us, then that's the thing that we need to really focus on. To say we're ruining, ruining the world, or you know, all that stuff, it's a little bit self-aggrandizing. We really need to take responsibility for our own actions. We need to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. We need to do it at the individual level and not wait for large businesses or governments to do it for us. And flying in space made me eternally optimistic. This is a magnificent place we live on. We're incredibly lucky to be here, and it's up to each of us what we do with that information.
That was a portion of Cross Country Checkup's AMA with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. You can listen to the show live on CBC Radio 1 or on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play wherever you are. If you'd like to listen to the full two-hour edition of Cross Country Checkup, you can stream the podcast on the CBC Listen app. And if you want to share comments or appear on the show, go to cbc.ca/aircheck. I'm John Northcott, filling in for Ian Hanna-Mansing. Thanks for listening. The next live edition of Checkup airs on CBC Radio, CBC News Network, and CBC News Explorer next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.